We'll begin with our first case, Aslan v. Financial Industry, 12-2250, and that would be Mr. Iavarone.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. May it please the Court. We're here today on a case that I believe has four primary issues, the first being whether FINRA is a governmental actor when it is acting in the capacity of either registering brokers, disciplining brokers, or enforcing rules and regulations of the SEC or its own rules designed to enforce those SEC rules. The second is whether the taping rule violates the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. And fourth, whether, if it does, did my client have a protectable interest? And fourth, I believe, is the matter moot.
Could you start with the last one?
Sure. I don't think it's moot. I think that, you know, my client, we did not at any time waste a moment in filing this lawsuit. He was terminated on May 4th, 2011 for this. We went in with our complaint on June 16th, 2011, less than 5 weeks after he was terminated. I think that this is, you know, the fact that this could happen and could happen again is reason enough to other people to not be mooted. My client is still, regardless, is still has been known in the industry as a tainted broker. It's a stigma.
Well, let's get more specific about this, okay? As of the date the district court ruled, the 3 years had passed, correct? From March 09, that was when your client left Brewer?
Correct.
And the district court didn't rule until April of 2012, so the taping rule was no longer effective as applied to him.
Correct.
So as of April 2012, let alone now, what relief could a court give your client?
Could give the same relief in that he should, that this was an unconstitutional rule, that he should never have been dictated.
No, that's the merits. What relief could the court?
What are the stigma removed? It's still with him. We're not asking for damages. We're not asking for anything. He is not a tainted broker. He did nothing wrong.
Okay. What would the order of the court say?
The order of the court would say that the rule as applied to him was unconstitutional.
And offer what relief?
I don't think we need any other relief than that, that other than that his name be removed from any type of record that shows that he was tainted in FINRA's file.
So you want to rewrite history?
No, I don't want to rewrite history. I want a taint removed. It's with him. It's there in his file. It's always going to be there. I mean, we're stuck in
the case with everyone. If anybody who is so-called tainted, would if we went your way, would that clear everyone? Would that erase everyone's taint?
Yep. It would, and, you know, we moved as quickly as possible. You know, I don't understand how the fact that there is a short period of time where we're told, you know, like Nick Iavarone's a tainted lawyer. He's going to be a tainted lawyer for X amount of time. We move it expeditiously. Suddenly, well, now he's no longer tainted. He was for this period of time. I don't want that associated with my name. That's a stigma. The fact is, this is known as taint. There's no good connotation that can come from being known as a tainted lawyer, a tainted judge, a tainted doctor, a tainted teacher. And I think it has to be expunged from the record, no different than an illegal arrest can be expunged from somebody's
record. So if he became associated with a disciplined firm, say, 5 years from now?
Yes.
And this taint was not removed, he'd still be subject to the taping rule. That's your point.
Yes.
I mean, the taping rule and the taint that he has experienced, he'd still have a cognizable claim, I guess. Is that your position?
My position is yes, because when he goes in to, he has done, I mean, we must start with the proposition that he's done nothing wrong. None of these people have done anything wrong. If they had done something wrong, they would have been charged and had all the Fifth Amendment rights that you need through their through FINRA's code of procedure when something is done wrong. But it comes down to every time you go for a new position, why were you terminated from your previous position? I was terminated from my previous position because I was a tainted broker.
So your bottom line is this type of injury is capable of repetition at any time.
Any time, and it can happen to any broker tomorrow. And it's something that what happens here is there's a secondary license created by this rule, which they have no right to create.
On this question of being capable of repetition yet evading review, that's the catchphrase in mootness terms.
Yes.
Could you address the case of City of Los Angeles against Lyons, where a fellow had been subjected to an arguably illegal police tactic upon his arrest, but there was no particular reason to believe he might be subject to it again unless he got arrested again?
Right.
And the court said that's not good enough.
I don't know if it could happen to my client again.
In theory, it could. We all recognize
right.
that.
But in theory, it could happen to any broker mm-hmm. tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Is he working now?
No, he is not.
Is he?
Well, he was working. He was going to be after the taint. was PFG Best was going to hire him back. PFG Best is out of business. So now his problem is he had a book of business. He's in his 70s. Nobody's going to hire him back. He lost everything when he was terminated here. And the reason is you're no longer marketable. If I have a Series 7 license and I've never come from a tainted firm and I'm in a small firm like this, and I'm sitting next to Mary Smith, who has the same background as I do, different firm, very capable broker. She's there. Suddenly, my firm, after I leave, is tainted. Now, what happens is that I'm suddenly a different type of broker. And if John Smith on this side suddenly gets declared as a tainted broker, my job is at risk. I have a different license than she does. It's not out there over that this is a license 7A. Nothing can happen to her because she's not tainted. When the list comes out, my name is on the list. And I'm at risk every time. Now, if you're a firm, and here's the bad part of this rule, is that the firms are doing nothing wrong. This firm didn't go out and hire somebody that was terrible. They hired somebody who later got tainted. You reduce your workforce once. If you reduce it once, you're never going to be able to reduce it again. So why would you ever hire somebody that currently is a tainted broker? Because if you do hire someone that's a tainted broker today, and you've already cut your workforce once, what happens if John Brown, who's been with your firm for 2 years, is suddenly a tainted broker because his firm just got disciplined? Now you have to implement this rule. So your marketability comes down. And this is, after all, an industry in which there are a lot of small broker-dealers. Yeah, if you're Merrill Lynch, you don't have to worry. 20% of their workforce, there aren't that many tainted brokers in the world.
How big was Brewer?
Brewer had like 30 to 40, I believe.
Well, they said 11 of the 17 people at Best were from Brewer, I believe.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's what they supposedly do. FINRA chases around
right.
where these people go, and are they going to start a new firm that did the same?
Except that none of these people, you know, I know in the brief they say that Aslan was there when some of these things happened, but he really wasn't. There are three things that happened. One is the owner of the firm was stealing money through a bond issue. Second, there were some minor regulatory violations. It's sort of like saying, you know, here's somebody charged with three murders, littering, and speeding, and it's the speeding and littering that got us. I can understand that if there's a sales violation. This is no sales practice violation. Man was never involved in it. And we're not saying they shouldn't do this. All we're saying is have a little standard and give somebody the opportunity to say, I worked on the other side of the country. I never sold these products. I've never had a problem. Don't hit me with being tainted. I understand that they have to protect the public and they have to act quickly. But there can be a very short 60-day summary proceeding where you say, here are the standards. I appeal. No. Go to the SEC real quickly. Too bad you're tainted. And in the meantime, they can put them on heightened supervision.
But the problem is they don't have any internal administrative process.
None.
And that's the whole problem. And you're trying to find another way to resolve that, and this is doesn't yeah. seem to have that.
And trying to do it in the way that would protect the public. And you can do it in a summary proceeding where it says, tell us why you should not be. As long as you have some standards. You know, I don't see how embezzling money as the head of the firm taints a broker in the firm who's done nothing wrong or somebody that may be working in L.A. or Connecticut. It makes no sense. I think I'm on my rebuttal time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Riker. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Riker.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Terry Riker. I represent the Defendant Appellee Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, or FINRA for short. I want to go right to the issue of tainting, because the only place that that word appears, tainting, tainted broker, tainting with a capital T or whatever, is in the plaintiff's papers. The FINRA rule at issue, which is Rule 3010B, doesn't use the word taint. It's not directed to individual brokers. The rule, in fact, is a mathematical calculation, and as my opponent said, it was enacted in order to prevent firms that shut down from having most of their representatives go to one or two other firms and start up again, which is exactly the reason that it was enacted in the 1990s.
What do they call it? It's not tainted.
There's nothing. The brokers aren't called anything. The rule basically is triggered when a firm exceeds a threshold of a certain number of brokers from another securities firm, when that other securities firm was either expelled by FINRA or subject to a final order of revocation of their license by the Securities and Exchange Commission.
How do they keep track of them? Is there a list?
There's a computer program there's a computer program that spits out a report when a firm is subject to one of those actions. There's a computer program that spits out a report that says this is where their former representatives are working. They look at the representatives who worked for the firm within the last 3 years. That's not an arbitrary thing. The reason for that is because if a firm was engaged in sales practice violations, and this only applies to firms that are shut down for sales practice violations, those are the types of violations that are most likely to have impact on customers and impact investor protection. And if there are firm-wide sales practice violations, there is a potential that the securities firm that was disciplined was not engaging in proper supervision, may have encouraged a culture that did not enhance investor protection. Therefore, we are looking at registered representatives who worked at the disciplined firm within the last 3 years. Computer program spits out the names and looks at firms that trigger a certain threshold. In this case, it's correct. Best Direct Securities, two-thirds of their registered representatives had come from Brewer, which was this disciplined firm. The individuals' names appear on a list. A letter went out to Best Direct Securities saying you need to implement a taping system. That's why it's called the taping rule. FINRA, and this goes to the constitutional claim, FINRA did not tell Best Direct Securities that they had to fire any brokers, let alone Mr. Aslan. The rule provides that firms that are affected by the taping rule have to implement a tape recording system in which they tape record conversations between their brokers and customers, and that they enact enhanced supervision for those brokers to make sure that the rules are being followed and that investors are being properly protected.
Well, that's pretty punitive, though, isn't it?
No, I mean, we don't see it as punitive. We see it as in
well,
we
whatever
see it as
you want to call it. But, I mean, it's obviously it's going to cost more. It's going to be more of an imposition. So when they when a firm hires somebody like that and then they get a notice that says you have too many of them, you either fire them or you go into for the whole firm this whole taping process.
That's I mean that's absolutely true. And this was a rule that was proposed by FINRA, was published in the Federal Register, was approved by the SEC under the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, set 15 U.S.C. Section 78. And the SEC considered all of this and passed and enacted adopted the rule because the rule enhances investor protection, because the SEC had in order to pass a rule, the SEC is required to make a finding that it's in the public interest and it doesn't impose an undue economic burden upon the firms that are affected, and the SEC has to find that it provides some that the rule provides some kind of fair process.
What administrative process did he have to challenge what he called a taint? You don't call
this,
it anything.
This goes to exhaustion of administrative remedies. Mr. Aslan has precisely the same remedy that any other individual who's a broker has to challenge a FINRA rule. Congress provided that he can go to the SEC under Section 19, which is 28 U.S.C. Section 78S, and 15 U.S.C. Section 78S, and ask the petition the SEC for rulemaking. He can ask the SEC to abrogate, modify, or vacate the rule. That is his remedy, and Congress intended for that to be the exclusive remedy for individuals or firms to challenge FINRA rules that are approved by the SEC.
What's the time limit on that challenge?
There is no time limit.
After the approval of the
rule.
Well,
after the approval. There's two separate things. One is when the rule is in the approval process. In that case, an individual must go to court. I believe it's within 30 days after the SEC approves a rule. But under 78, but under Section 19C of the Act, which is 78SC, and the SEC can abrogate, modify, or vacate a FINRA rule at any time. That implies that anybody can go and petition the SEC for rulemaking at any time. This is something that Mr. Aslan could have done and failed to do, and the exhaustion doctrine has been applied by other courts to FINRA in its disciplinary and in its rulemaking capacity.
And has anyone challenged that particular provision under the scheme that you just identified in terms of the taping rule and particular rule?
Not that I'm aware of. There was a case. We didn't cite it in our papers because it wasn't that relevant. There was a case challenging the taping rule, I think, in 1999, in Florida, but that was by a firm that claimed that, and it was after the rule was enacted, but that was in response to a claim that it was forcing the firm to violate the Florida Taping Act. So it really wasn't. So no, you're right. There's never been a challenge of this nature.
Maybe an impossible challenge. I guess if you're talking about exhausting, if he went in and challenged it with some perfunctory filing or letter, I don't know how you challenge it. But then
there's a process for petition for rulemaking.
Okay, so one person does that, and then they say, you lose. And then what?
At that point, he can come to this court or another U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The regulatory scheme that Congress intended for judicial review of National Securities Association rulemaking, because they found it necessary that FINRA have one regulator, the SEC, and not be subject to hundreds of lawsuits and potentially hundreds of federal courts challenging different FINRA rules. The SEC has regulated FINRA since 1939 and has the expertise to determine if FINRA rules are appropriate or if they should be changed. That's the system of administrative review that's required.
But they're not a state actor.
No, that's why I was just going to get to that.
Before you move into the governmental actor question, mm-hmm. I'm a little troubled by what you just told us about exhaustion of administrative remedies. In your brief, you tell us that the procedure under Section 78Y is the exclusive remedy to challenge a FINRA rule. Is that right?
That's for judicial review, yes. But before that, I believe it does say in the brief he has to petition the SEC first. And the SEC will make a determination.
Okay, that's 78Y. Now, A minute ago, you were telling me, no, the remedy is under 78S.
78S is where the SEC, under 78S, the SEC has the power to abrogate, modify, or vacate FINRA rules. Right. He can petition for rulemaking.
So how many different mechanisms are there?
There's one. He goes to the SEC. If he doesn't get relief at the SEC, he can come to the United States Court of Appeals at that time.
Under 78S or 78Y or something else?
78S is the provision under which the SEC considers FINRA rules. 78Y is the provision under which he can obtain judicial review of a determination by the SEC. With the court's permission, I'd like to proceed to the constitutional issues. The constitutional claims fail for two significant reasons. One is the reason that the district court found, and that is that there's no – FINRA didn't take any action against Mr. Aslan that impacted – that deprived him of a liberty or a property interest. FINRA did not censure him. FINRA did not fine him. FINRA did not suspend him. He is free. He was always free to register with a firm elsewhere, and there's nothing on his record that indicates that he was censured, that he was in any way disciplined by FINRA. To the extent that he's alleging that he doesn't have that there's some kind of reputational injury, the Supreme Court and other courts have already found that that does not create a liberty or a property interest that rises to the level of a constitutional claim. The other point is that, to my mind, the more important one is that FINRA is not a state actor. No court that has ever considered the issue has ever found FINRA to be a state actor in any capacity, including the capacities that Mr. Aslan cited in his argument, in a disciplinary capacity, registration capacity, or a regulatory capacity. In fact, Mr. Aslan has cited no cases holding that FINRA is a state actor.
Before you go on further with that, can you just address the mootness argument, because, you know, his position is it is capable of repetition in terms of him applying again for a position, and this could happen again, and also the fact that, you know, this could go on for some period of time, as I understand his argument.
But, I mean, it's moot in that at this point, his name will not appear on any list. It's true. If he registers with another firm and that firm is expelled or kicked out of the industry by the SEC, then it's possible that his name could appear unless he's with the firm for less than 90 days. Our position is that it is moot at this point, and that whatever he does in the future is sufficiently speculative. He might register with another firm at some point. That firm might be subject to disciplinary action, but the situation which is before this court has been moot for some time.
And was moot, under your theory, when the district court ruled?
It was moot, under our theory, when the district court ruled. He was no longer, at that point, he was no longer, his name no longer appeared on the list. But to get back to the state action issue, FINRA is not, the test for state action is this. The plaintiff has to prove a specific nexus between the specific conduct complained of and the state. There is no nexus alleged here or anywhere in the record. And, in fact, every court that's considered the issue has found that FINRA is not a state actor. Now, this circuit hasn't addressed it directly, but in Otto v. SEC, this circuit did say that it expressed doubt that FINRA was a state actor. And in support of that proposition, it cited two cases holding that FINRA is not a state actor. One of them is Desiderio versus NASD. That's a Second Circuit case, and these are all in our briefs. There's a Second Circuit case considering the exact arguments that were advanced by Mr. Aslan in this case. The other that was cited was First Jersey Securities versus Bergen. That's a 1979 Third Circuit case. Now, there is one case that Mr. Aslan did argue applied that was decided by the circuit, and that's the R.J. O'Brien case. R.J. O'Brien versus Pipkin. That's a 1995 case. That case does not apply to FINRA. It was decided under the Commodities Exchange Act, which is 7 U.S.C. Section 21, and that's a completely different regulatory scheme, and that act specifically delegates a securities industry registration function to the NFA. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934, under which FINRA is registered, does not so delegate, and this court declined to apply R.J. Pipkin when it had the chance to consider FINRA as a state actor in the auto case. And the Desiderio case was also decided by, which was decided by the Second Circuit, came out after R.J. Pipkin and did not use that analysis at all. The plaintiffs must show that there is specific conduct by FINRA. In this case, the specific conduct is the enactment of Rule 3010B, which is the taping rule, and there is no showing that there was any nexus between the government. The government did not mandate, coerce, unduly persuade, or anything. There's nothing on the record that shows that the government forced FINRA to adopt Rule 3010B. This is the securities industry rule. FINRA is not a state actor. There are no constitutional claims in this matter.
But they still put him on a list for 3 years. And
he was on absolutely. He was on a list. It's basically a mathematical calculation. His name appeared on a list, and the only impact of that list was that his firm had to make a decision as to how they were going to comply with Rule 3010B. It was Best Direct Securities, not FINRA, that determined that it did not want to implement a taping system and that it wanted to adjust its staffing levels instead. FINRA did not force anybody to fire Mr. Aslan. These were decisions made by his former firm.
Apparently Best went out of business, didn't it?
I believe it did, but that is a separate matter. I have having something to do with its parent company.
Thank you, Ms. Riker.
Thank you.
How much time?
I want to address something. First of all, while the Securities Exchange Act does not state that FINRA has authority over registration, and that goes to the R.J. O'Brien case, that's true. But 17 CFR 240.15B7-1, enacted May 1st, 1993, states that you cannot do business with anybody unless they are registered with, essentially, FINRA, with the self-regulatory. So what was expressed in the Commodity Exchange Act from the beginning now is the same with the Securities and Exchange Act as pursuant to that regulation beginning in 1993. I want to get to mootness again and to the exhaustion of remedies, but as far as them being a state actor, I'm not saying they're a state actor in every instance. Obviously they're not. If they're arbitrating between members, if they're setting prices, if they're setting their ethical standards, they're like any other private. All of the cases that are cited by FINRA in these have to do with arbitrations, have to do with somebody trying to stop an investigation, somebody trying to short-circuit an investigation. But there, I don't see how you can have R.J. O'Brien and say that FINRA is not an actor when they're acting in this specific capacity, which is impairing a license. Getting to the remedies, what they're saying is your remedy here is to petition the SEC to change the rule. Am I supposed to go somewhere when there is an unconstitutional act and petition the state legislature or state regulatory? If my constitutional rights are being violated, I have a right to come to court. If it's going to be moot when we act it as fast as we can, how is it every case not going to be moot if you have to go through trying to change a regulation? That's what we're talking about here. And if the SEC says, you know, maybe you're right, what happens? They send it out for comments. How long does it take to change an SEC regulation? A year and a half? Then you go to district court. It's always going to be moot. So you have to have a remedy. Saying to change the law or to change the regulation, if it is unconstitutional, is not a remedy. The remedy is the Constitution. It's void, and that's it. I don't think anybody has to do anything else. Otherwise, for all constitutional rights, people are going to be made to jump through meaningless hoops. As far as what was hired here, remember, Mr. Ashland came, and all these brokers came at different times. They didn't all come in mass. But Mr. Aslan had been there for a long period of time, has never been engaged or threatened with anything. And it's going to continue to happen. I'm sort of stuck where we have a government that can do something, and as long as they say we're only going to do it for 2 or 3 years, ha-ha, you've lost your income, you've done all this, but there's nothing you can do about it. Maybe it'll happen again, ha-ha, and it's going to happen to Joe next door. We're seeing it happening all the time to firms, and we're not trying to stand up for those that did wrong. The people that did wrong are being charged. My client did nothing wrong, and he lost his business. And for them to say they're not doing it, you saw the letter. You have a choice. Terminate these people or put in the taping system. They know how expensive it is. So if they're putting my client's name on a list saying, hey, if you terminate him, fine. I thank you for your time.
We'll take the case under advisement. I'll call the second.